danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 216 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Owings Mills, Maryland. I am Andrew Brokus.
And from New York, New York, doing his best Nate impression, is Clayton Fletcher. Hi.
Hi, Clayton, and thank you so much for doing this, on short notice and then on even shorter notice, finding out that you are our Nate tonight. Unfortunately, he was not able to join us, but we are very excited to have Clayton back for third appearance on the podcast, fourth?
I don't know if it's third or fourth, but I tell you, I really love being on this show. As you know, we met because I was a fan of your podcast and mentioned your podcast on another podcast, and which eventually led to me being a guest. So it just proves that it pays to promote the Thinking Poker Podcast if you're ever on another podcast, although it doesn't pay in the literal sense.
But it doesn't pay.
Yeah, it's beneficial.
This is still the Nick cast.
Yeah, of course. Of course it is. Who are we talking to here?
Well, and I've had the chance to become a Clayton Fletcher fan because since the last time you were on the show, I have been to your comedy show in New York City.
Yeah, that was really fun having you in the audience, but a little bit nerve-wracking. You know, it's always scary when there's someone that I know in the crowd. I almost prefer to do it for a group of strangers, except for the fact that it's nice to have your friends support you. But it's just a little bit more, it's a little bit more scary. It's a little bit more pressure for me.
That's easy for me to imagine.
Yeah, it's just, you know, if a bunch of strangers see me bomb, that's one thing. But if someone that I actually respect, like you, shows up in the crowd, it's like, oh man, I hope I get some laughs tonight.
Well, I was actually a little nervous myself, just because, you know, I contacted you and said, you know, hey, my girlfriend and I are in town, and you know, well, if you're doing a show tonight, we'll come by. And you know, you told me to just tell the doorman that I was on your list, and it just feels like such a, you know, just like every douchebag in every movie is always like, hey man, I'm on the list. You know, it's just like, I've never had to do something like that before. So I was like, I'm on Clayton's list. And the guy like kind of like looked at me skeptically and like flipped through the list. And yeah, just like, I had these visions of him just like rolling his eyes and kicking me out.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't know a Clayton and there is no list. So get out of here, buddy. I don't know who told you to come here.
It turns out the whole thing has just been a scam that you wouldn't give up on until the last.
I've actually never done comedy before. That's weird. No, it was great having you guys there. We got to chat a little bit. You were in town for a number of reasons, but if I remember, one of them was you were doing the thing with Just Hands.
That was a separate trip.
Is that right?
Yeah. Those were two separate trips. Okay. Yeah. That was just, I have a good friend, actually one of the people who kind of, my college roommate who got into poker the same time that I did. He lives in New York City. So, I mean, that's often the primary reason that I'm going there is to visit him and his family. But yeah, I mean, you know, one doesn't really need a reason to go to New York City. There's plenty to do there.
Yeah, I never noticed. Yeah. It is, I mean, it's just, there's no place like home. The only thing that they could do to improve New York for me is allow us to play some kind of poker legally here, whether it be online or live. It's just, there's no poker in New York City that's not illegal.
That's, I mean, there's a casino that's supposed to be opening close to the city, isn't there?
Well, you know, they did open one somewhere in Queens or Westchester or someplace like that, but I don't believe that they allow poker. I think it's just gambling.
Oh, that's too bad. Yeah, that always seemed.
I might be wrong.
Maryland, could be wrong. Maryland did the same thing. Where like when they first opened the casinos, you know, first it was slot machines only, and then they had table games, and poker was like the last thing that they added, which just seems to me. I mean, I guess it's just that their actual interest isn't like protecting customers or anything like that. But, you know, for all the talk of, we don't want problem gamblers and blah, blah, blah. And then just to introduce like the absolute worst forms of gambling first and save poker for last makes sense. I mean, if you want safe gambling, slot machines is the absolute last thing you should be allowing in your state.
Yeah, we don't want to create a state filled with problem gamblers. So let's just give them all of the bells and whistles of these highly entertaining and extremely addictive slot machines. Right. Yeah, that won't cause anything. But don't let them play poker where they might actually have a shot at winning. Yeah, it's a little backwards.
So what do you think the prospects are for running into each other in Las Vegas this summer? I'll be there for the entire series.
As will I, so I'd put it around 100%.
Nice. Is this? Yeah. You don't generally do the whole series, do you?
Yeah, actually, the way I look at it, Andrew, it's doing comedy, much like playing in a poker tournament, has an EV. So there's a week right in the middle of the series. This happened last year, too, where I actually can make a little bit more money doing comedy shows than I expect to make playing in the tournament. So that means I have to miss a couple of the events that I was kind of looking forward to playing, the Monster Stack specifically, and the Bounty event. But yeah, so I'll basically be there the whole summer except for 1 week right in the middle that I have to dip out and just remind myself that I'm supposed to be a comedian too.
Yeah, I mean, having a week off is pretty nice, really. I think there's a decent chance I'm gonna try to take some breaks. I mean, I definitely don't want to be burned out going into the main event, but yeah, I wouldn't beat myself up too much over that. That's probably a plus EV move anyway.
Yeah, maybe it's for the best, especially if I don't get off to a great start. It is kind of nice to have that little break.
Yeah.
But yeah, some years I'll just go for the last 3 weeks, but now that they've started doing all this really high-value stuff kind of in the beginning, I feel like it's worth it to go at the beginning. And then if I need to go do comedy, well, no one needs to go do comedy, but but if a good opportunity arises for me to go make some money, that I'm sure I'll make money when I tell jokes. Sometimes when I play cards, believe it or not, I actually lose money. I'm sure that's hard for you to imagine, but it happens to me. Whereas with comedy, every time I tell jokes, they pay me. So that's a what we call a sure thing. So, but yeah, I think having that break in the middle to kind of get back to my semi-normal life may actually be good for my psyche and help me reset if I don't get off to a good start.
What's so great about this 1 week comedy-wise?
It's just they're paying me more than what I usually make for doing comedy, so I'll be going to basically sell my soul.
But is it like a particularly high tourism week, or like what's special about that week?
No, it's just the particular gig that I got. There's a couple of corporate gigs in there.
Oh, okay.
And any comedian can tell you the best source of income as a company to pay you money, because companies don't seem to care how much you try compared to comedy clubs and other places like colleges and other places that we perform. So yeah, it's just a really good spot.
Nice.
This happens to be around the same time as it was last year, right in the middle of the World Series. So
that's why I thought it was, because yeah, you mentioned doing it last year also. I thought maybe it was like some comedy festival or something that was like a particularly...
No, nothing like that. It's just a good chance to make some guaranteed income, which depending on how my first half goes, I might be in debt of that income. So I'd be like, I gotta go get me back quick to tell some jokes. Dance, monkey. But I always hate missing each day of the series. It's just, it's hard for me to be away from Vegas during the World Series. I feel like I have to worst case of FOMO than I do.
Yeah. And, but I mean, speaking of FOMO, are you bringing the family out there with you, or are you going to be missing out on them the whole time?
I'll be missing out on all of that love.
Wow.
And, yeah, that's the hard part. Oh, speaking of family, Andrew, I wanted to make an announcement that's going to be really good news for cash game players. in the greater Baltimore metropolitan area. My mother has officially retired from poker. She's not playing anymore.
Oh, I don't think I ever got the chance to play with her, or at least I didn't realize it if I did.
Oh, you probably would have known if you had. Have you ever played against a really sweet-looking librarian-type old lady that somehow managed to get all your money? Then you would know. At the end of that session, you would have said, are you Clayton's mom? But yeah, you know, we lost my dad last year.
Yeah.
And that was something that none of us have really gotten over. And my mom in particular, you know, she really enjoyed playing poker and discussing poker with my father. And I basically, long story short, walking into a casino now just reminds her of him too much. And she actually took a part-time job at Macy's for a while and did that just to kind of keep herself occupied. And she really enjoyed it. She said that Clayton is great. Every time I go to work, I make money.
You're like, shut up, Mom. Quit rubbing it in my
face.
Mom,
every time. Yeah, I know. Right? Yeah. So,
think you're so great
yeah,
with your steady
fine.
Income.
But yeah. Yeah, but I'm still trying to talk her into coming out to have some kind of family with me in Vegas. You know, when I had that deep run a couple of years ago, to me the highlight of it was having my mother there at the time when all hell broke loose and I went from like fifth in chips to out in 96th place.
Yeah.
In a matter of about 10 minutes. Nothing like having your mom there to cheer you up, and especially my mom, who actually knows about poker, to kind of all the right things to say and all the dumb things not to say, was a real blessing. So I'm hoping that I have a bunch of... Yeah, I don't know if you realize, but I'm sure you've heard the news, but I'm not sure if all your listeners know that the final table won't be happening in November.
Oh, yes. Yeah. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a good move. I feel like the original intention of the November 9 was to spend the time between July and November building up these 9 players and getting people interested in which one of the November 9 will end up being the champion. And then that strategy didn't really end up happening on ESPN from a marketing standpoint. And it just ended up being, well, now for no reason, we have to wait 4 months. to see. I mean, the intent was a good one, and there was one year where it was kind of exciting when Phil Ivey was there.
Yeah, although that was for kind of the exact opposite of the reasons they thought. I mean, because like the whole idea was we need to turn these people into celebrities, and then it was the one person who was already a celebrity that was sort of like the year that the November 9 actually captured excitement.
Right. Yeah, they didn't really have success in turning knowns into celebrities or people that the public at large would become interested in for. But, you know, that I don't think that's necessarily a reflection on the player that made the November 9. I don't feel like everyone involved in the marketing was on the same page about, okay, so once we pause from July to November, we need to get these 9 faces all over the media and get it in the big final table. I just don't feel like that happened. So,
yeah, I think that's right.
Where actually, it happened. It's players that might not have been that good at final tables had 3 or 4 months to practice. So that was good, I guess. They won't have that this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was sort of an interesting dynamic. Or, you know, I always thought it was sort of neat to see, like, what did various people do to prepare for the final table. And I do like the idea. I mean, I know some people were kind of against it because they didn't want the playing field to be leveled. But it's not like it really leveled the playing field. I mean, I do like the idea that, you know, someone who was a pretty amateurish player and you know, didn't maybe enter the main event really thinking they had a realistic chance of making the final table, but happened to get there, would have the chance to catch up a little bit. Like that sort of seemed sporting to me rather than unfair.
I can see both sides of that argument. But actually, while you were just talking, I realized why Nate decided not to join us tonight. It's because he lost a prop at your final table. I don't... And you know, we talked about this on Twitter, and so it's been discussed publicly. I just can't remember if I talked about it on the show or not. But Nate and I made a prop bet that I'm now convinced, by the way, was a bad bet on my part, where I laid him 10 to 1, $1,000 to his $100, that he couldn't pick the main event winner if I gave him 500 chances. So if I didn't explain that well, Nate sent me an email with a list of 500 poker players. And if anyone on that list won the main event, I would owe him $1,000. And if anybody else in the world won, I would get 100 from him. And after I made the bet, which I thought was a good bet, I talked to enough people that know more about this stuff than I do to know that I made a terrible bet, and I think it was probably closer to 6 or 7 to 1. And if he wants to do it again this year, he's not getting that good of a price.
Yeah, I'll tell you two things. One is that just hearing that, if you hadn't told me who against whom you were betting and you just told me the terms, I would say 10 to 1 is too high of a price. But right. Two, don't make a bet like that against Nate. He knows more about this than you do.
Right. And
more than a I lot do. That's not specific to you. That's specific to Nate.
No, and a lot of people know more about this than I do, but not too many people know more about this than Nate does.
Right.
Because he's really the authority on these things. But, you know, my thinking at the time was there are going to be about 7,000 players, and so the chance that you could pick the winner is 7,000 to 1 if you don't have any information and you knew all the players. So... Yeah, you have to be sure of who was playing, you know. So I worked backwards from there, but not really taking into account how much Nate knows about who plays the main event and who doesn't, and also not taking into account the chances of one of the professional players on Nate's list winning. You know, actually much higher than, you know, he had a great bet there, and I just happened to win it because somehow Kui Win was not on that list of 500. Believe it or not. Yeah, but he had a lot of, I think he had 3 horses at the final table.
Wow.
Out of the list of 500 players. So he was very interested in every hand. You could probably guess who they were if you asked Nate, who do you think the 500 most likely winners are? You know, the 3 of them were at that final table. I don't think I want to say who those 3 were because someone else that Nate knows that wasn't on the list might be offended.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So yeah, that's why he's avoiding me now, and he didn't want to do the show with us.
So what else have you been up to? I mean, have you had much time for poker? I know you can't really do it in New York.
Yeah, but you know, luckily my job allows me to travel quite a bit. I got to play a little bit in Sweden, which is fun because, you know, I get to play against idiots from Northern Europe. As Phil Helmuth would say. No, I really like the casino in Sweden, although the rake is astronomical. I think they take out 10% up to $10.
Yikes.
Of course, they don't use dollars, but, you know, when I did the math, and the exchange rate and everything, it seemed like a very high rate. But it's just a beautiful casino and really nice place to play poker in Stockholm. I also got to play in a couple of tournaments. I think I've played about 10 or 12 tournaments already this year. I made a final table in a little tournament in Florida, which was fun. And I made almost a final table at Borgata last month, so I'm feeling good. My poker is going well. I'm feeling confident. I'm thinking about the game the right way, I think. And I've done a lot of homework this year. I'm really ready to play.
Nice. And what does homework look like for you?
So I actually mentioned you on several other podcasts recently because one thing I've been doing, I've been watching a lot of your videos on TournamentPokerEdge.com. Sponsor of this show. Also, some of the stuff that you have on YouTube that I've watched before, but I check it out. You know, I really think that you have the right style as far as teaching, where you don't necessarily say this is right and this is wrong, but I like the way you kind of give players another way to think about something, and that really helps me. That kind of communication registers well in my brain, and so I feel like that kind of homework has helped. I've also just been watching a lot of videos of last year's final tables that are up on WSOP.com, and just kind of checking out of what players are doing nowadays. But I mean, I feel like there's no substitute for experience, but I really feel like to learn any complicated subject, you need both theory and practice.
Yeah.
So I try to get a good blend of both.
Yeah, you know, the thing that has probably been like the biggest change for me since the last year, and it's funny because I've read other of Zach Elwood's stuff. You know who Zach Elwood is, the reading Poker Tells, Verbal Poker Tells, right. Splitting Poker Tells. Yeah, so I mean, I read several of his earlier books more than once. But I mean, I guess it is that combination of theory and practice, because I feel like the physical tells stuff is clicking for me a lot more recently than it has been. And it's the sort of thing where, you know, I've been playing live poker for a while. I mean, for the first half of my career, I really was almost exclusively online, and I kind of didn't expect that I was going to be that good at physical tells, but like I've been playing mostly live poker since Black Friday. The majority of my play has been live, and I feel like I've been getting better at that sort of thing to the point where I was starting to, you know, pick up on actionable stuff. But really, just even in the last few weeks, a lot of stuff's been clicking for me to the point where, you know, I just got back from Montreal, where I was playing the Spring Championship of Online Poker, and I really felt the difference for the first time. It reminded me of, there's a quote from Mike Caro, where he's talking about going from playing five card draw jacks or better, where people would just, you know, make it really obvious when they didn't have a hand. And when he played different games where people weren't so incentivized to do that, it was almost as if someone had like turned down the volume. And he was like missing out on this really important information. And that resonated for me when I was playing online, which has never been the case before. Like, I've always been, you know, at least as comfortable online as I was live. And this is the first time that I was just like, boy, I really wish I could look at this guy right now. I've never had that feeling before. So I'm looking forward to, you know, getting out there, especially, I mean, WSOP, when you get so many amateurish players who are really deeply invested in the outcome of every given hand. That's like the perfect storm in terms of tells. You get people who aren't experienced at not giving off tells, combined with people who really deeply care about the result and are emotionally invested in the result. And I think there's a lot of information to be mined there.
Most definitely. This is really terrible news for all of your opponents, because you were already such a strong player that now, I feel like on this show, if you listen to previous episodes when I was your guest, I would sort of bring up something about a physical tell that I picked up, and you wouldn't necessarily, you know, just count it out completely, but you tended to say, well, the math is the math, and the, you know, in other words, I never got the feeling from you that tells were going to be something you would invest time and energy working on, and now that I know that you have, this is just... I would say that it was a piece of the puzzle that I didn't expect you to fill in. So now that you have, I feel like, boy, people are in trouble. I hope I'm not at your table.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, buddy.
Yeah, are you selling any action?
I'll PM you.
Okay, sounds good. No, I think this is great. I started, of course, playing around the kitchen table with my mom and my brothers. That was always about tells first. So my approach to the game has always emphasized that, in some cases, more, you know, to my own detriment. So I would take some physical vibe that I got from somebody and make a huge decision based purely on that. which I think the average online player can't imagine doing.
Yeah, I cringed a little when I heard that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I cringe sometimes at the result of seeing how you could misread a tell and cost yourself a whole tournament. But there were, you know, certainly times when picking up this or that, especially from, as you say, an amateur opponent who's very interested in the outcome and, you know, not used to playing for the stakes and all those kind of things. Those kinds of reads that you can get are extremely reliable, in my experience. You just have to know who your opponent is. If, Jonathan, that's no reason for you to put your whole stack.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, you have to really, it's very opponent dependent. You kind of really have a profile of who you're up against. But yeah, I think that's a very important part of the game. And actually, as a comedian, that's the part that I like the most because my regular job is reading people.
Sure.
And so that's what it's all about.
Anything else you want to talk about before we move on to strategy?
Yeah, I wanted to tell you the rest of my homework. I've challenged myself to go to the gym every day in the month of May. And I'm proud to say as we record this on May 25th, I haven't missed a day. So
nice, I'm feeling congratulations.
Strong. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm taking care of myself. I'm doing all the studying we talked about. And I feel so excited. Last year's World Series was an epic fail for me. I cashed in the first tournament that I played. I played about 16 or 17 events last year. Not all World Series events, but, you know, big tournaments, whatever, in Vegas. And I cashed in the first one. I made five more day twos, but I still only cashed in the first one.
Wow.
So that was somewhat devastating. You know, you get all excited, you know, when you know you got shit. And I didn't stack in any of them. I have, you know, just, it seemed like every time I made day two, all hell broke loose the next day. And so I'm very eager to get that bad day. There's a lot of ways to lose, but that hurts a lot.
Yeah, it's funny. Unlike your mom, my mother is not at all versed in poker. And literally just last night, I was explaining to her the concept of worst place, which is actually worse than last place, which is exactly what you describe when you end up, you know, playing right. for a particularly long time and still not cashing. Like, I would much rather get last place than worst place.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
The which I guess is a little bit of a like cynical poker player viewpoint, because I mean, and it depends on the event. Like in the WSOP main event, I'd still rather, you know, bubble than go out on day one. But there's not that many poker tournaments that I enjoy in the way that I enjoy the main event. And there's always another poker tournament. You know, it's not like I'm done playing poker tournaments if I bust one early. But I guess that not everyone has that perspective. I think some people really are just in it for, they're only going to play so many tournaments, and they would like each one to last as long as possible, even if they don't end up cashing it.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the main event is a very special event, and there's nothing like it in the world. There's certainly nothing like it anywhere else in poker that I know of. So, yeah, I agree that whereas normally I'd rather just take last and get on with my life, you know, to have the worst finish in the main event would really, really suck. maybe a little more than getting worst place in that one. Because, yeah, then at least you have the experience and the anticipation and all the stories to share over a drink later with your friends and all that stuff. But as you well know, there's nothing like having a deep run in the main event either. And so I wish that for both of us this summer.
Yeah, certainly. Clayton Fletcher is doing his homework at tournamentpokeredge.com, and you should too. Whether you're preparing for the World Series of Poker main event, or your next Bar League tournament, or anything in between, you can find the resources you need to improve your tournament poker game at tournamentpokeredge.com. You'll find videos from myself, from Nate Mavis, and from many former guests of this podcast at tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy hand today, possibly our first, possibly our only strategy hand today, is coming to us from Andrew. Not this Andrew. This is an Andrew in merry old England. Andrew says, we're playing £1, £2, no limit hold'em. The villain in the big blind has been defending his big blind pretty often to the standard open of £8. He's of Middle Eastern origin, well-built and stocky. Doesn't look to be intelligent, in parentheses, rude, I know. An aggressive player who has check-raised bluffed on a couple of flops. He is an aggressive player who has check-raised bluffed on a couple of flops when out of position. He has £420, so 210 big blinds, after losing £200 in the previous hand. Andrew is on the button with ace-four of diamonds. Action folds to him. He says, standard open here, I think, and I bet £8. Small blind folds. Villain calls in the big blind. So with £17 in the pot, the flop is jack of diamonds, jack of spades, five of diamonds. The villain checks. I just kind of skipped over the pre-flop action because that seemed pretty straightforward to me. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, that's a very uncontroversial decision to raise on the button with an ace in a cash king. Sure.
So we flop the nut flush draw now. We know that the villain is pretty check raise happy and that he calls pretty wide from the big blind. £17 in the pot. What do you want to do?
Yeah, I think I would bet it. I really don't mind getting check raised that much because I probably have the winning hand or, you know, the better hand at the moment anyway. And I can cheerfully call a check raise. I don't mind if my opponent wants to put more chips into this pot because I think my hand is probably good. And yeah, I don't really mind if he wants to check raise, and I don't mind if he calls either.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, basically the he can check raise as much as he wants. What he can't do is, you know, have a better hand than ace four of diamonds very often, right? Especially if he's calling a lot from the big blind, he's going to see this flop with a ton of weak hands. And, you know, when you bet, his only two options, well, three options, you know, he can fold his weak hands, he can call with his weak hands, or he can raise with his weak hands. And really, you win no matter what he does. I mean, even if you bet ace four of diamonds and he folds queen nine of spades, that's still kind of a win for you. I mean, you're not a huge favorite against queen nine of spades. I mean, you certainly benefit from him folding that hand. If he decides to call with it, that's a win for you. If he decides to raise with it, that's a win for you. You know, you're just really far out ahead of his range. You have a hand that doesn't mind putting a lot of money in the pot. You have a hand that doesn't mind getting folds. Yeah, I think there's every reason in the world to bet here.
Yeah, so we agree. How much should we bet? I guess I would put in £10.
Yeah, I definitely don't think we want to bet on the big side. And actually, Andrew says this as well. He says, I don't want to bet too big, as this will make his option to three bet less appealing. And so I agree with it from that perspective. And in terms of, you know, exploitively, if we actively want him to check raise here, then we don't want to bet a really large amount. In fact, I could see betting even smaller, you know, perhaps as little as £6 or £7. The reasoning being, I think this is a flop because of what I just said, you know, how wide the villain is calling from the big blind. Even though we're a button opener, I still think that the hero is going to have a pretty significant range advantage on this flop, just, you know, having all these big pairs in the hero's range that are not in the villain's range, and the villain probably has some weak hands that the hero would not have opened on the button. So I think the hero has, like, a pretty decent range advantage here, but also almost every hand the hero could have is a hand that benefits to some degree from protection. Even a strong hand like ace four of diamonds, we really don't mind betting and getting a fold from queen nine of spades, as long as we're not risking terribly much to get it. So I think this is a spot where, you know, the hero can continuation bet pretty aggressively, even with a hand much worse than this one, and, you know, wants to bet a lot of hands on this flop, which I think argues for using a pretty small sizing. So I definitely think that you and Andrew are on the right track, and I wouldn't even mind going even smaller than what you guys have suggested. But I think as long as you don't bet too big, you're on the right track.
Great.
So Andrew bets £12, and the villain does indeed check raise. Andrew says it was very quick and only slightly more than a minimum check raise. The villain makes it £28. Speaking of physical tells, Andrew says, quick bets seem to be either air or strength, which in this case would mean a jack. If it's strong, then I have good odds, and we're deep enough to make the call. So yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think I think he's right about the meaning of a very quick check raise. I do think, you know, even if it's air, again, you know, his air does have decent equity against this hand, so I wouldn't absolutely hit. And I think we actually have a strong enough hand that even if we 3-bet in the villain 4-bets, I still wouldn't really feel compelled to fold. So I wouldn't absolutely hate putting in another raise here, but I would probably lean towards calling. Does that sound right to you?
It does. I'd like to chime in a little bit about the physical tell he picked up on with the timing.
Mm-hmm.
I have found in my experience that quick bets tend to be air or strength, but more, I would weigh them more towards air.
Yeah.
If you really think about it, the old adage is strong means weak and weak means strong. Well, if I'm betting very quickly, that seems to be something that someone would do with a lot of confidence, right? But poker players tend to try to deceive their opponents. So one that's showing confidence by betting quickly and strong, that's usually a sign of weakness. A lot is, of course, villain dependent. A lot of people know about these conventions when it comes to reading tells and body language and things like that. So some of us, myself included, will do reverse tells on purpose. We bet very quickly, knowing that our opponent will assume that means we're weak, but we're actually very strong.
That's what I was about to say. I do think that the very quick bet being a weakness is, it's one of those rare tells that's sort of so widely known that I don't think it's that. You know, for the most part, I still am rolling my eyes at the idea of reverse tells, especially from, you know, recreational players. But I think this particular one is so well known that I'm a little more willing to consider the possibility of a reverse tell.
Right, but if we consider that our general read of the villain is that he's not too intelligent, rude, I know,
yeah,
then not give him credit for being able to go to that level of thinking.
It is rude, but I do also have an idea of what Andrew means. I mean, I'll admit I do sometimes look at a person, and I'm not, and I don't think Andrew is either, attaching this to the fact that the villain is Middle Eastern, but I do have the sense of sometimes just looking at someone, and I'm like, that person just can't be a good poker player. Just look at his face.
Right, yeah, well, yeah, we know, we all have a picture in our minds right now, as you say. Enough said, and yeah, I agree that obviously it's not so much about his origin, but you know, he did include some details, like he's well built and stocky and doesn't look that intelligent. So I'm getting more of a picture of kind of a, I don't know, someone in high school we might have called a meathead,
right,
or something like that. You know, so we had the image of this caveman that's check raising all the time,
yeah,
just being really aggressive. So yeah, with that in mind, I think I would weigh this bet a little bit more towards air for that reason as well.
Agreed. So Andrew does in fact call the raise, and we go to the turn with 73 pounds in the pot. The turn is the 7 of diamonds, giving Andrew a flush with his ace 4 of diamonds. So the board is jack of diamonds, jack of spades, 5 of diamonds, 7 of diamonds. Andrew says, villain bets again, 100 pounds this time. So it's a significant overbet of the pot, which was 73 pounds. Andrew says, I don't know how sensitive the villain is to his bet sizing, but this is more than the pot and certainly shows strength. Yeah, I don't know. Do you interpret that as strength?
Well, you know, not sitting there at the table, it's hard to interpret it at all, to be honest. But since we don't have the luxury of being there, normally I would say that this seems weak again. The bottom line is we have the ace high flush against an opponent that we've observed making aggressive check raises. Now, you know, the correspondent doesn't mention anything about check raises followed up by huge overbets on the turn.
Right.
And I mean, what I always think about is when Squansky wrote that the most recent and most valuable information we have right now is that a large bet has been made.
Right.
So that's what I'm looking at here. And I take this 100-pound bet into a 73-pound pot pretty seriously, but honestly I don't know if there's much I can do about it, because against this opponent I can't imagine folding a flush, especially not the ace high flush.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know that him representing strength necessarily means we want to fold. Like, it might mean that we want to raise all in and just think that he's representing strength with a hand that's weaker than ours, whether a lower flush or a bear jack or something like that. I'd also very curious to know the timing of this bet. This is another one that Elwood writes about it, although I can also remember another instance where someone taught me this lesson. When a card like a third diamond, a flush card falls, and if the villain were to act very quickly when that happened, I think it would make it less likely that he has a bear jack, because you can kind of imagine if he had flopped trips and he check raises and gets called, then suddenly a flush draw gets there. He would probably want to think for a moment about, what do I do? Did I just get drawn out on? Or, you wouldn't necessarily expect, especially not that he would fire out a very large bet with trips when, arguably one of the worst cards in the deck just got there. I wouldn't expect a very quick big bet from a jack. I guess I would expect him to have been more likely to be trying to bluff that he has the flush, possibly with a worse flush draw than what the hero has, or maybe he just got there with a lower flush draw of his own, and now he's thinking he has a big hand and he wants to bet a lot with it. I would think that a jack or even a full house is kind of less likely, because I think those hands would want to consider the implications of this new turn card a little bit more. I mean, assuming the villain that quickly, and we don't know that he did.
Right, but yeah, I think for the sake of argument, we should assume that he did. And I think that I would add to that, if this particular opponent likes to check raise bluff on flop, I'm not sure that he would check raise value bet very often on flop. It doesn't strike me as someone that would balance his check raising between bluff. So if we've caught him check, or the table has caught him check raise bluffing a few times, I would actually assume that the check raises that he does on flop are probably less likely to be ever for value, because I just find that players with this profile don't tend to balance their ranges in the sense that when I'm check raising, I'm just as likely to have a jack. I guess what I'm trying to say is I feel like if this player had a jack, he probably would slow play it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So what do you think this means for the hero's action? I think if the hero just calls, we'll leave 273 pounds in the pot and maybe slightly more than that in the effective stack. Do you want to call or risk?
Yeah, I suppose that raising's only going to be profitable if our opponent has a strong hand, such as a flush that we can beat, or a bear jack, which seems unlikely, given everything we just discussed. I do think that many, many players would check raise with the flush draw on this flop. And so that's really what we want him to have, right? We want him to have some, basically drawing dead flush right now is what we want him to have. If that happened, okay, so I think I would call, because if our opponent has a flush, he's likely to put more money in on the river anyway. And if this bet's a bluff, we're going to lose him if we raise. So I don't see how, if he's strong, I don't see how the money's not going in on the end.
Yeah, there's not a lot of action killing rivers. I mean, I guess a card that pairs the board, or another jack or something, would be bad. And a fourth diamond wouldn't be great if the villain has, 8-9 of diamonds or something. He might get a little worried when the fourth diamond comes up there, but there's only so many of those, and as you said, I think the majority of the rivers were going to stack hands that would have called a turn shove anyway. I also think, if this player is semi-bluffing with king-queen with a diamond or something, it sounds like there's a pretty good chance he's going to stick the rest in on the river even when he misses. That's the other consideration, is does he have a draw that would call all in now, but is then not going to put money in on the river unless he gets there. But this player sounds to me like one who is, not just going to check down king high with one pot size bet left in his deck.
Agreed. I think, I feel like this money's going in on the river almost no matter what hit.
Yeah, so I like to call.
Yeah, we should just call and let him do that.
And that's what Andrew did. He said, I have to just call, thinking I want to keep the bluffs in his range. With hindsight, I just don't think that's what I should be targeting here. I should probably bet, targeting the jacks he may hold, as he is not going to put more money in the pot unless he has a hand that will also call a raise. That said, calling leaves him just over a pot-sized bet on the river, so it might not be that bad. Admittedly, this did not enter into my evaluation. As played, I called. And you've heard his thoughts on that.
Yeah, I take it to mean he thinks he should have raised the turn.
Mm-hmm. And I do think there's more of a case for raising if we think the villain could have a jack. I guess you and I are discounting that a little bit more than Andrew was in game.
Right. Right. Yeah, so I agree with the play, and I disagree with the opinion of the play.
So we do see the river with 273 pounds in the pot, and I believe about 290 remaining in the effective stacks. The river is the eight of hearts, making the final board jack of diamonds, jack of spades, five of diamonds, seven of diamonds, eight of hearts. Our hero holding ace four of diamonds for the ace high flush. The villain checks. What do you make of that?
Well, we definitely, well, I shouldn't say definitely, but we almost definitely have the best hand when our opponent bets 100 on the turn and then checks the river. And I think that we should shove. We're just going to get the, we should be able to get action from flushes. And if he does have that unlikely jack, and I think the most important point here is we can't be worried about whether we're beat.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think we certainly should conclude that we have a hand that, you know, we're prepared to play for stacks, or, you know, that right. We want to value bet. And then the question is just how do we best get that value?
Right. Yeah, I would stick it in.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this doesn't sound like the sort of player who's going to make a hero fold on the river. we are making some assumptions, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't make hero folds. Like, 1-2 players don't make hero folds. This player does not sound like he's going to be an exception to that rule. And, I mean, people are supposed to call a lot when they're getting 2-1 on the river. I know it feels like a lot because you're betting, you know, more than 100 big blinds, but the pot is very large. And, you know, to make a roughly pot-sized bet on the river, you know, the villain should be calling that bet pretty often. My guess is the hero doesn't do a tremendous amount of bluffing in this situation, which, you know, probably implies he expects to get called pretty often here. And if the villain doesn't have anything, he doesn't have anything. I mean, you can't force him to call with king high by betting, you know, half the pot.
Right. My read changed a little bit on the villain, just in the sense that I don't feel like he's bluffing anymore.
Right.
You know, when he... I feel like had he been bluffing with that 100 on the turn, he would pretty much always stuff this river to try to get us off of whatever we call his turn bet with. And the fact that he's now checked it, I think he has some kind of showdown value, which makes me want to shove even more.
Yep, I agree with that.
Okay.
And, you know, again, it's also like, even if he was bluffing, that's not the part of range, if his range, we should be worried about. This, you know, how can we squeeze another $50 out of king queen with one diamond? You know, that's right. He probably wouldn't call $50 of that hand anyway, but I just think we should be a lot more concerned about stacking his strongest hands.
That's a good point. This is a time when we need to be optimistic that he's got something to call me with.
Yeah.
So, yeah, right. So yeah, stick it in and see if you can get him to call you.
Andrew says, after villain checks, with the way I've played it, I don't think he would need to slow play a boat, so I'm pretty confident I have the best hand. I'm torn between jamming or betting half the pot. I decided to bet 140 pounds, and villain snap calls. I show my flush. He shows me jack of hearts, king of diamonds. He also says he would have called the shove, and so I start berating myself for missing the remaining 150 pounds. Is it that obvious I should just stuff this river? Yeah, it kind of is.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. I don't know why you saved that money.
I think people are just really reluctant to make, you know, I think this is, I mean, again, we're making some assumptions here this time about Andrew, but I think it's a pretty common thing that people just, they really want to get paid when they have big hands. And it's kind of similar to like a loss aversion, where people would rather just increase their likelihood of winning something rather than, you know, taking the slightly higher risk option of, you know, possibly winning nothing additional by shoving. But I think when you break it down, the risk just isn't really that high. I think most hands that are going to call 140 are going to call a bigger shove anyway. But I understand the mentality of, you know, 140 still feels like a lot. So you're still going to sort of like feel like a winner raking in a big pot. But I just think you need to sort of get beyond that and find the shove.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know. Probably a lot of our listeners do this already. But one thing I like to do is calculate the EV of betting 140 versus shoving by saying how often do I think he would call the 140 and how often do I think he would call the shove.
Right.
I was going to assign a higher frequency of calling the smaller bet, but I don't think it's that different. It's certainly not different enough to make the 140 bet a more profitable one, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But it's kind of fun to play with those numbers, like how much more often would I need to get called to make it the right play and just kind of figure out where that line is. As you're going through hands you've played, I think that's a kind of a fun thing for the mathematically inclined to do. It's certainly something I play with a lot where I'm surprised how often I conclude that I should have shoved.
Yeah, that's often my value betting advice to people is just, you know, when in doubt, bet bigger. And I think this is kind of a problem with just trying to play by feel, which is, you know, of course, exactly the opposite of what you're suggesting, where you're saying, you know, kind of quantify it, because you don't get into these kind of situations that often. Like, you don't often have, you know, a 280 big blind pot or 140 big blind pot on the river, you know, with the opportunity to shove 140 big blinds. It's not a spot you're in that often, and you don't have a well-developed feel for it. So yeah, I think you need to be able to think it through theoretically to find the most profitable play. And it really is a big difference. I mean, the 150 pound, like I think the difference in EV is pretty close to 150 pounds. And you know, that's a lot of money in a 1-2 game. It is a situation that, you know, doesn't come up that often, but it matters a lot to get it right when it does come up. You know, it's not a small mistake because of the magnitude of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I agree with that. And I'd like to add that I'm surprised he check raised the flop with Chris. So we don't know this villain at all.
Yeah.
But I do think that he would need to be folding to the shove a lot more often than people realize to make betting 140 better.
Yeah, it should be just about twice as much. You know, like he would need to call the half pot bet, you know, twice as often as he calls a river shove. And yeah, I think you and I are on the same page that's not realistic.
That's not realistic. No, not at all.
No, we've probably just made Andrew feel worse about himself. So I want to end on a positive note here, which is that Andrew ends his email by saying, "I ended the session after 3.5 hours to avoid playing tired and making more mistakes. This is something I've never done before, either because I want to grasp the opportunity to play while I can, or because I've made the journey with a friend and so feel the obligation to stay. I have to say I felt good for it, like when you've made a good laydown and saved yourself money. The 210 big blind profit probably helps, but let's hope results-oriented reinforcement has a positive side to it." And I think this is awesome. I'm sure Tommy Angelo would approve. Making the good quitting decisions is so important, both for your immediate profit and just for, you know, he's going to go home feeling good about his play, feeling like even though he made a mistake in this hand or suspects he made a mistake in this hand, he still, you know, has a nice profit. And, you know, I'm not just saying you should quit for the sake of locking up a win, but, you know, if you find that you do tend to get tired in long sessions or you tend to get tilted if you suspect that you made a mistake in a hand, ultimately that's something you'd like to get beyond, but you know, quitting is a really good, really profitable band-aid. And, you know, it's quite possible that the hero made himself more money with this quit than he cost himself by not sizing his river bet as well as he could have.
Definitely. And on the subject of quitting, I feel like many of my cash game sessions end up being in the 3 to 4 hour range. I tend to have to use the bathroom about every 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And on my walk to the bathroom, I always sort of have a conversation with myself. Okay, Clayton, how good is your table? What is your table image? How do you feel right now? And I kind of check in with myself to really try to be honest with myself. Because when you're in the heat of battle, you might just feel like, oh, yeah, I came here to play poker. I'm going to play poker all night. But, you know, if you're not in a good game and your image kind of sucks and you're maybe not playing your best for a myriad of reasons, it might be a good time to leave. And it's always easier for me to make the decision to quit when I'm not sitting at the table. When I'm standing at the urinal, that's when I do my best work. Sad as that may seem, it's true. So yeah, I agree. I really like this paragraph here where Andrew describes his decision to quit. And I think that it's a very underrated decision. You know, you have an hourly rate, but it's not the same every hour.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, too. It's not the same every hour. That's something I need to hammer home for myself.
Yeah, we all do. You know, and especially if he's still thinking about that money he didn't win from this villain. Let's be honest. Andrew doesn't like this villain. He describes him in a very pejorative way. He knows he doesn't like him. He had a chance to get the guy's stack, and he left some money on the table. And that can be just as tilting as losing a big pot or even taking a bad beat. Even more so for most of us, because that's a mistake that Andrew made. And a lot of us beat ourselves up. My own worst critic, right? Beating myself up over the mistake that I made. So, you know, quitting after making a mistake is probably one of the best things you can do if you're aware of the fact that you now have vendetta tilt. You know, you think about how much you hate that player that still has that 150 that you should have now. And why is he so big and stocky? And why does he look so stupid? And, you know, I know that we're all human and we have these thoughts that go on in our head sometimes. And to be mature and say, you know, I can play again next weekend or tomorrow or whatever the case may be. Sometimes that's just the right move.
Yeah, that's a big warning sign for me, too. I mean, I don't tilt hard, and I think I don't tilt that often. But I also don't often find myself thinking, like, really deeply unkind thoughts about people. I mean, I'll have sort of, like, dismissive, like, you know, oh, that was dumb. You seem like an idiot. Like, I mean, stuff like that will go through my head. But it's rare that I'm just sitting there, like, you know, staring daggers of hate at somebody. And if I find myself doing that, that's a pretty good sign that I'm not on top of my mental game anymore. And, I mean, it does happen, but...
Right, yeah. And, you know, somebody just... Sometimes I sit down and maybe I didn't have enough sleep the night before.
Yeah, that's
and before one. Anything, before anything's even happened, I already have strong opinions about half the players at the table.
Look at you and your stupid goddamn hat.
Yeah, why are you wearing that ugly hat? And, well, why are you talking to the waitress like that? You know, and I check in with myself, like, are these people annoying me just by being humans?
Right.
And if that's the case, I probably shouldn't be playing. And I have recently, very recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've developed the skill of, you know, I can play poker for 10 minutes and go home. I'm not feeling it today. I haven't paid attention for the first 3 hands. This is not a good start. I'm only down 20 bucks. Let's just get out of here.
Yeah.
Go do something else, you know. And that's important to be able to do that. I know Tommy Angelo talks about being able to go and play one hand and leave.
Mm-hmm.
I've literally done it.
I can't say that I have, but I have advised some students who really had problems with quitting to do that. You know, just I had one student who it was in London also. He said it took him about 40 minutes to get to the casino, and so he always felt like he had invested so much in getting there that he didn't want to leave even if he knew he wasn't playing well. And so I encouraged him, you know, drive over there, play one orbit. I couldn't tell him one hand because I couldn't have him pass up those free hands once he played the one. You know, Nick is. But I said play one orbit. You know, don't, when it's your big blind, pick up, leave, drive home. Just do it once to say that you did it, and then it won't feel like such a big deal in the future. And he told me it helped.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, the times that I've done it, I had other offers on the table of what I could do that night. So, you know, it's like I kind of don't feel like being here anyway, and now I'm in a bad game and I'm in a bad mood. Maybe I should go get drinks with friends or go see a show or whatever else the options were. It's nice to, and when you're in Vegas, there's always something else to do besides playing poker. Although during the World Series, it's hard for us to remember that.
Yeah.
Because we all get very pokerized when we're out there, and it just becomes like we're all machines just grinding. And, oh, if I don't play every single event and I don't spend all my free time in cash games, I'm leaving money on the table.
Yeah, what if this is the one I was going to win?
Right, exactly. But, you know, thinking that way can cause you to leave life on the table, so that's not good either.
Ocean of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you want.